Hello, this is Mary Mortland reading the News Gazette Part 1 for Thursday, September 13, 2018. University of Illinois, Obama on campus, what it cost. Last week's appearance by former President Barack Obama at the University of Illinois cost about $53,200, some of it covered by the 44th president himself. Much of it was internal, transferred from one department to another, paid by the U of I President's Office and the Institute for Government and Public Affairs. None of it came from tuition dollars or state appropriations, said U of I spokesman Tom Hardy. Here's a breakdown of approximate totals. Fullinger Auditorium, $19,214, covered rental, setup, and use of the auditorium. Obama paid about $12,500, providing the teleprompters, media riser, and the blue backdrop for the stage. Huff Hall, $10,120, covered setup for live streaming of Obama's speech, including chairs, large screen, TV screens, and sound. Security, $16,740, covered police officers from the U of I, Champaign and Urbana, and security personnel, and equipment at Fullinger and Huff. Award ceremony, $5,300, covered the Paul H. Douglas Ethics in Government Medallion, and catered and set up the President's House. Paid by an endowment fund at the U of I Foundation, created in 1992 to support the Douglas Award. Miscellaneous, $2,090, covered some catering costs, bagged parking meters, and the printing of tickets, signs, and flyers. Unified Future, the Goal. Chief Illini WIC report urged, develop new traditions yet honor the divisive past. A report from last spring's conversation on Chief Illini WIC recommends that the University of Illinois explore the idea of a mascot along with other new traditions, but also commemorate the history of the chief on campus. With a focus on finding common ground, it also calls on the campus to teach people about Native American history and imagery, engage the community in Native culture, and continue a dialogue with alumni and other groups to build understanding and respect. And it urges the campus to come up with a clear plan of next steps with regular updates to ensure transparency. Chancellor Robert Jones said the campus is already working on some of the short-term ideas suggested, such as historical commemoration of the chief and strengthening ties with the Peoria Tribe of Oklahoma. And the reports call for a commission to delve into some of the recommendations and come back with an implementation plan is already in the works, he said. The panel will include representatives of different stakeholders in the chief debate, who must be committed to finding a common path forward, Jones said. Otherwise, we don't get anywhere. Clearly, we're not going to be able to do everything that's in the report. We need a way to vet some of those ideas and to broaden opportunities for people to participate, he said. The report, obtained by the News Gazette before its general release today, provides a roadmap for the campus following the April 10th critical conversation on the chief and three follow-up sessions with alumni and the general public, which were designed to provide some consensus on the divisive 30-year-old chief debate. Altogether, more than 600 people took part. The report from an advisory committee led by Rusty Barcelow, a special assistant to the chancellor, said 3 decades later the campus and community remain deeply fractured, citing a shared sense of exhaustion, confusion, and anger that we are not further along in the process. It urged the campus to continue the process to help the community, acknowledging its past and continue to unite. It does represent for us one of our best opportunities to move beyond this really divisive issue, to find a place where we can truly honor Native American heritage and culture, as well as provide an opportunity to really engage with our alumni in a much more effective way around this issue, Jones said. While the views expressed during the conversation showed that polar opposites remain, the report said there is a wider range in between than we had anticipated, including those who are still seeking answers about the chief and its retirement or who aren't sure how to resolve their feelings about the chief with their current values. Most people felt alienated by the school's response to the controversy over the past 11 years, the report said. No single idea can solve this issue. Therefore, strategic, multifaceted approaches will contribute to new traditions at the University of Illinois are needed, the report said. Participants had varied ideas for what those should be, but given the U of I's 2007 action to retire the chief, the committee focused on ideas aimed at a unified future, the report said. One heard repeatedly was that the university should introduce a mascot or develop new traditions to bring closer to the issue, the report said, as recommended by a 2016 Student Government Committee and endorsed by the Academic Senate. Jones said he will ask the commission to look deeper at ideas and come back to him with a recommendation. We're not going to try to avoid the issue of discussing a mascot, but it has to be done in a very thoughtful way, with more input, he said. We're not saying absolutely no at this point. We just need additional time and analysis to decide if there's something we're going to pursue or not. He thinks developing new traditions is a separate issue that could be tackled on a much shorter timeline, Jones said. Plans to ask the commission and student groups to consider things that could generate more excitement at athletic events or about the university in general. The bottom line, the chancellor said, is that the chief isn't coming back. It's a part of our history, he said. The report said participants felt the U of I's process for dealing with chief-related issues after the tradition was retired in 2007 wasn't well documented. Many alumni felt they weren't given a chance to grieve the loss of the chief. There was a strong desire for the U of I to make a statement about the reasons for ending the chief tradition, though people disagreed about how to acknowledge competing perspective on that issue, and most wanted a formal documentation of that part of the U of I's history, the report said. The advisory committee recommended documenting the history of the chief and Native imagery on campus through storytelling and archival tools. Among the suggestions were a museum exhibit and an oral history project, possibly using the StoryCorps model to collect reflections about the chief from American Indian students and faculty, the Council of Chiefs, community members, U of I trustees, and student activists. The report said some participants also felt the U of I has a responsibility to teach students accurate information about American Indians, including a history of the university, the land it occupies, Native imagery, and Chief Illiniwek. Jones said the campus will continue to seek input on a historical commemoration, promising it will be fair and honest and appropriate. We're not going to try to bury history, he said. Chief Illiniwek was a part of this university for 80 years or more. The campus is also doing things already to make sure Native people are at the core of everything we do at the university, Jones said. Starting last spring, the chancellor began opening all important campus events, including commencement and the freshman convocation, with a statement acknowledging the fact that we're on the land of the people who came before us. One thing that came through all involved, any process moving forward must be transparent and collaborative, involving people from a variety of perspectives, including alumni and Indian members of the campus community, the report said. That's an absolute commitment, Jones said. Jones planned to send copies of the report today to the Peoria Tribe, the Honor the Chief Society, the Council of Chiefs, and the others on all sides of the debate. He believes more people feel like their voices are being heard, and there's a coalition of the willing to find a solution. With all of the conflict over the past year and beyond, he said, the status quo isn't sustainable. We have to ask ourselves, what is the end game? What is the long-term vitality of where we are now, he said. It's been stuck for the last decade or more, a very divisive and uncomfortable place to be. Champaign Public Library. Underground Sensation will appear tonight. Initially, Charlisa Hart wasn't sure about a book that dared to reimagine the Underground Railroad, Pulitzer or no Pulitzer. Why, my grandmother grew up in the South and was part of the Great Migration, so I thought, how can you change something so powerful? Then I started reading it. The Champagne Woman said of Colson Whitehead's celebrated novel of the same name, oh my goodness, it was so well written, continued Hart, who put meeting the author on her bucket list. The way he made it a real railroad and brought to life the characters and destinations didn't take away its meaning, it brought new life to it. Published in August 2016, The Underground Railroad was a number one New York Times bestseller and racked up a slew of awards, including the Pulitzer Prize and National Book Award. It also made numerous rating lists, including Oprah Winfrey's and former President Barack Obama's. Hart can barely believe she'll get to meet Whitehead and hear him discuss the novel at the Champaign Public Library, 200 West Green Street, this evening. An Evening with Colson Whitehead, hosted by the Table Talk Book Club, is part of the Great Authors at the Library series. The free event is made possible with support from the library friends, and no tickets are needed. Due to Whitehead's popularity, both the main library and the Douglas branch will close at 5 p.m. Then the main branch will reopen for the event, which begins at 7 p.m. on the second floor. Doors open at 6:30. Right now, we're projecting 200+, said Brittany Michaels, the library's deputy director. We'll do our best to accommodate whomever arrives. Whitehead, a Manhattan native, will autograph books following a discussion and question and answer session. Copies of the Underground Railroad will be available for purchase on site. The library describes the book as a shattering meditation on the United States' complicated political and racial history and chronicles a young slave's journey during a desperate bid for freedom in the antebellum South. It was a page-turner, said Oyada Hani, a longtime member of the Table Talk Book Club. The group, which has been meeting at the Douglas branch to talk about books by contemporary black writers for 16 years, suggested Whitehead for the Great Authors series. It really humbled you to read about what people went through, said Hanny of Urbana, whose ancestors include slaves and an American Indian great-grandmother whose family was removed from their land. I think students should read it. What they teach in school about the Underground Railroad and slavery is just a few pages. Students don't get much history. This is a great reference book for them. I laughed and cried, said Hart, a Table Talk member for 2 years, but a voracious reader all my life. It was very sad, she said, referring to brutality the protagonist and her fellow slaves face in the story. Knowing that in real life many people endured similar, but it was also inspiring no matter what the main characters endured, they persevered. Hanny said reading the novel prompted her to research Whitehead, a MacArthur Foundation Fellow in 2002. In April 2017, he was one of Time magazine's 100 most influential people. She also read two of his earlier works, Sag Harbor and Zone 1. Jim Dive's column, In and Out of Prison and Court. Today is the big day for Alan Beeman, the former Illinois Wesleyan University student who was convicted and later cleared of charges that he murdered his Illinois State University girlfriend in 1993. Beeman spent 13 years in prison before the Illinois Supreme Court overturned his conviction in May 2008 on the grounds that McLean County authorities improperly withheld exculpatory evidence from the defense. Now the same court is being asked to rule on the question of whether Beeman can sue the city of Normal and three of its police officers for malicious prosecution. I just feel like this case is way bigger than me at this point because this is about the whole state, he said. Both the criminal and civil cases growing out of the Beeman case have been unusual from the very beginning. For example, before the Illinois Supreme Court agreed to review Beeman's civil case in the appeal to be heard today in Springfield, it decided on November 22, 2017, that it wouldn't hear it. Then, acting on its own, it announced a couple weeks later, December 8, 2017, that it would. The petition for leave to appeal is allowed, the court said, without an explanation in a cryptic three-sentence notice to Beeman's legal team. The question before the court is whether Beeman can sue Normal and its police officers for the role they played in his prosecution. A state appeals court ruled that he could not sue the city because prosecutors, not police officers, make charging decisions. Prosecutors have legal immunity from civil lawsuits. The case is, in some respects, similar to the recent civil rights lawsuit a Champaign man, Tashomi Campbell, filed against the city of Champaign. Campbell, who also was convicted of murder and served time in prison before his conviction was overturned, filed his lawsuit in federal court. He recently received an out-of-court settlement of $3.5 million. Before going to state court, Beeman filed a federal civil rights lawsuit, but his case was dismissed because, according to a federal appeals court decision, Beeman did not present enough evidence from which a reasonable jury could infer the existence of a conspiracy to conceal exculpatory evidence. While lawyers for Normal will argue Beeman's lawsuit should be dismissed because police officers are not involved in charging decisions, Beeman's lawyer will argue that police investigative efforts are so integral to the process that officers cannot be excluded from it. It's that contention that prompted 11 prominent former prosecutors, including former Governor James Thompson, former Illinois Attorney General Tyrone Fainer, and former State Police Director Jeremy Margolis, to sign a legal brief backing Beeman's right to sue for monetary damages. Liability for malicious prosecution deters this type of investigative misconduct, they argued. The former prosecutors contended Beeman's conviction was caused by a corruption of the criminal process in which police officers participating in his prosecution abandoned their roles as unbiased investigators and pursued Beeman at all costs. The case began on August 28, 1993, when the body of Jennifer Locke Miller, who was from Decatur, was found in her apartment. She had been stabbed and strangled. Investigators quickly focused on her former boyfriend, Beeman, as a suspect between the two because the two had a stormy relationship. But Beeman was living at home that summer with his parents, and he claimed that he couldn't have committed the murder because he wasn't in Normal when Locke Miller was killed. Authorities, however, alleged that Beeman drove from Rockford to Normal to visit Locke Miller and became enraged when he found evidence in her apartment of her relationship with another man. That, authorities said, is when Beeman allegedly killed her. Authorities focused on numerous male acquaintances of the victim as possible suspects. The Illinois Supreme Court overturned Beeman's conviction because it said the case against him was weak and authorities withheld evidence about another suspect from the defense. Years later, evidence would reveal that DNA material recovered from the victim's body came from none of the original suspects. Authorities who reopened the Locke Miller investigation as a result of the findings said it came from two so far unidentified males. That revelation, coming after Beeman's conviction and a 50-year sentence was overturned, prompted the McLean County State's Attorney's Office to drop its opposition to Beeman's request for a certificate of innocence. Beeman subsequently received a court-approved certificate of innocence and a state compensation of $175,000 for the 13 years he spent in prison. Former Governor Pat Quinn also granted Beeman a pardon based on innocence. 20 years old at the time of Locke Miller's death, Beeman is now 45, married with two daughters ages 14 and 16, and works as a design engineer at a tool company in Rockford. He and his older daughter participate in community theater performances at Rock Valley Community College. Beeman, who will be joined by family and friends at Thursday's hearing, said he's looking forward to oral arguments and hoping the seven justices will find that public officials should be conducting themselves with honesty. It's all about the cookies. Tonight at the Illinois Terminal, the Girl Scouts of Central Illinois will honor WCIA newscaster, U of I Class of 93 alumna, and active volunteer Jennifer Roscoe at their 2018 Women of Distinction, their 2018 Woman of Distinction. On the eve of the annual Diamonds, Desserts, and Distinction Gala, Roscoe took time out to answer a few questions. What's your message for today's Girl Scouts? More than ever before, women are changing the world, and we need to be a part of that. Whether you're impacting one person or an entire school, don't be afraid to use your voice and be a leader. You sure had the opportunities to move up and on in the broadcasting business. What's kept you in CU all these years? I realized a long time ago I didn't need to work in a large market to be happy. I have a job I love, I can tell amazing, inspiring stories, and I get to live in a community where people truly care about one another. What do your daughters think about Mom being a woman of distinction? They're hoping I get free cookies out of this. I'm hoping it shows them all the years they had to share me, and I wouldn't be at home at night and made a difference in other people's life. But really, it's about the cookies. St. Thomas More, a bipartisan talk in school. The students at the High School of St. Thomas More had done their homework. By the time U.S. Representative Rodney Davis, Republican, Illinois, arrived Wednesday morning with Representative Jimmy Panetta, Democrat, California, in tow for a talk on bipartisanship, students had prepared questions that showed they were, at least in general, paying attention. Davis and Panetta had come to tout each other's bipartisan efforts in Congress, pointing to their shared work on the Congressional Agricultural Research Caucus, despite their rival affiliations. "It could be real easy for me not to be bipartisan," Panetta said. "It's a binary system and set up like that, but I made efforts with people like Rodney to get things done." But the students had other questions, such as what it was like for Davis to see unseat Rodney Davis bumper stickers in abundance. "You'll always see opponents make those efforts," he said. "The good news is we think we have a lot of support and we'll get reelected." Others wanting to know the two representatives thought about Americans who remain skeptical of politicians. Both suggested that social media and TV news was to blame for creating a sense of divide in the country and didn't accurately capture bipartisan efforts. "You might not hear about it, but there are men and women out there who will work together," Panetta said. "The one time I told people to turn on the TV was John McCain's funeral because we could see there are people who would actually stand up and do the right thing. That's what gives me hope." Some students wanted tangible examples of bipartisanship. Panetta pointed to the caucus he'd formed that Davis also joined, noting that despite being from two different states with two different agricultural interests, the pair of congressmen had shared interests and the caucus helped further those. Davis pointed to the 2017 shooting of a Louisiana congressman during a baseball practice. "The moment of bipartisanship that means the most to me was after the congressional baseball shooting. Jimmy was up to bat at the Democratic practice, and then I was up to bat at the Republican practice when a gunman came and tried to kill my friends," he said. The bipartisan group of members that came and said they were tried calling and texting, "It really sent a message to me that reinforced what Jimmy and I are doing." Davis and Panetta had their own question, too. For example, how many STM students were considering following in their footsteps and running for office? Only one, a girl who sat clutching a binder in the back, raised her hand. "If someone asked me that in high school, I wouldn't have raised my hand either," Davis said. "Sometimes your goals, as you grow older, you may change what your priorities are. But stay engaged and vote, vote, vote." Election 2018. No recusal in store for county clerk. Republican Champaign County Clerk Gordy Holton will not recuse himself from a board that will hear objections to three county board candidacies. That was the only matter decided Wednesday at a county electoral board meeting about the candidacies of Republican District 6 hopeful P.J. Troutman and Democrats Chris Storr and Charles Young running in District 10 and 6, respectively. Urbana attorney Ruth Wyman, representing the Democratic candidates and the Troutman objector, argued that Colton should step aside because he endorsed Troutman. Champaign Mayor Deb Finan served as an attorney arguing on behalf of Troutman, told the board that the case law says allegations political bias are not enough to prompt substitution of a board member, and the three-person board unanimously agreed. Holton, speaking with the News Gazette media after the hearing, said candidates can appeal the electoral board's ruling to the circuit court. The board will reconvene soon to hear an issue it brought up, whether the objections were filed on time. If the board rules they were, then attorneys will argue the merits of the cases. Holton chaired the electoral board Wednesday alongside Republican Circuit Clerk Katie Blakeman and First Assistant State's Attorney Steve Ziegler, who was filling in for a Democratic State's Attorney Julia Reitz. Apartment building fire, cause of blaze unknown as demolition begins. Construction crews have begun demolishing an apartment building destroyed earlier this year by fire. Green Street Realty's building at 609 South Randolph erupted in flames April 27th, displacing 97 residents. Investigators were unable to determine a cause, and the building has been boarded up since. The building was ruled to be a complete loss by the insurance company, and we have started the demolition process, Green Street Realty owner Chris Saunders said in an email. I would expect that we will have the building down in the next 4 to 6 weeks. While Green Street Realty is planning to build something new at the site, he said, as of right now, we are not sure what that will be. Investigators do not believe the fire was intentionally set at the building constructed in 1995 and bought in 2014 by Green Street Realty. Arraignment, man held in mugging and stick-up. A Chicago man linked to 2 muggings in Champaign earlier this month remains jailed in lieu of $100,000. Bond, Othar Taylor, 19, was charged Monday with aggravated robbery and robbery in a September 2nd mugging and attempted aggravated robbery in a Saturday incident. Judge John Kennedy appointed the public defender's office to represent Taylor and told him to be back in court October 23rd. Champaign police said that in the September 2nd holdup, a University of Illinois student was walking on the sidewalk on Green Street between Neal and Locust Streets when he was approached by a man who forcibly took his wallet. That happened about 7 p.m. that Sunday. Then about 2:35 p.m. Saturday, a person later identified as Taylor approached a man in the 1300 block of South Neal Street and allegedly demanded money while implying he had a gun. A Champaign police officer in the area saw it happen and began a brief foot chase that led to Taylor's arrest. Police said Taylor admitted his involvement in the Saturday incident and the earlier one in Green Street. If convicted of the most serious charge, robbery, Taylor faces penalties ranging from probation to 4 to 15 years in prison. Suspect in drug deal charged. A Champaign man currently on parole was charged Wednesday with allegedly possessing heroin he intended to sell. Judge John Kennedy told Demario Hilson, 32 of the 1400 block of Queensway, that he could face up to 6 to 30 years in prison if convicted of possession with intent to deliver a controlled substance. The charge against Hilson stemmed from his arrest Tuesday in Champaign. Members of the Champaign County Street Crimes Task Force had a search warrant for his home, but prior to serving it, they followed Hilson as he drove to a fast food restaurant in the 0 to 100 block of East Anthony Drive. There, they saw him allegedly attempting to conduct a drug deal with a woman in the parking lot. When police approached, Hilson dropped a bag of suspected heroin on the ground. Assistant State's Attorney Tim Sullivan said the suspected drugs weighed about a half gram. Because of prior convictions for delivery of a controlled substance, Hilson faces Class X penalties for the Class II felony. Sullivan said Hilson is on parole for aggravated driving under the influence from 2016, but also had other convictions for fleeing and eluding, driving under suspension, possession of cannabis, and resisting arrest. Blaze guts garage and car, but no one hurt. No one was hurt in an early morning fire Wednesday that destroyed a garage and a car and damaged a home. Fire Chief Ken Waters said the fire caused an estimated $60,000 damage to the home of Bill and Martha Brown, who escaped with their pet dog. No one was injured. Firefighters were called to the house in the 700 block of Juniper Drive at 1:38 a.m. This has been Mary Moreland reading the News Gazette Part 1 for Thursday, September 13th, 2018. Please stay tuned for Part 2.